Anthony Menninger versus Janet Marie Menninger. Please be seated. All right. Mr. Gadberg, would you like to reserve a portion of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
You have that, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Edwin Gadberry from Chesterfield County. I'm very happy to be here today. One of the reasons I'm happy is because this is a very simple case. This is a personal record for the shortest appellant's brief that I've ever filed with this court or the Supreme Court. My brief is 12 pages long, and my colleague has filed an even shorter brief than mine. This is a single-issue appeal arising out of a show cause hearing where three issues were presented. On that day, there was a hearing scheduled for 30 minutes. There were three issues before the court, and by the time Mr. Clements and I finished our remarks to the judge, and it was a substitute judge. It was not the judge that had originally heard the divorce case, so we were both working to bring him up to speed. By the time we finished our remarks and had some exchange with the court, our 30 minutes was over. There were some issues among the three that were, because it's a divorce case, hotter issues than others. More important that we have a decision, and the court did decide, made a ruling on all three issues. The main one that we wanted at the time involved the sale of some real estate. And the court did decide that one, and that's been resolved. There was a second issue that involved deductions from spousal support. That issue has been resolved. The issue that we're here on today was the third issue, and it, in order to be heard properly, it required some testimony.
I believe you said, I knew I couldn't get the tax man here.
Yes, sir.
For this 30-minute hearing.
That's exactly right. And I suggested to Judge Campbell at the time that he may want to, he had suggested going back to talk to Judge Rockwell, who had been the original judge in the case. I suggested to Judge Campbell he might want to either defer the issue to Judge Rockwell or defer it and have Judge Rockwell set it for an hour. I used the word at the time, set it for an hour. That's actually still what I'm asking for. Is just the opportunity to have the facts of that case heard. That is an unusual and more complicated issue in a divorce case than the usual simple issues of spousal support or single asset equitable distribution.
Is there any evidence in the record anywhere that the husband's 2012 distribution from John Hancock was, in fact, $12,000? Or was any specific amount? Do we know that?
No, sir. And in fact, that's a point that I'm going to raise, or I had intended to raise before I was done with my argument, and I've discussed this.
I thought it was sort of agreed. There was no such distribution in any amount that year. I mean, I didn't think counsel differed on that. The question was, should have there have been?
Well, to address the two points you just raised, Judge, I don't think that counsel has conceded. I don't think we're in agreement that there was no distribution. I made the statement in August five different times to Judge Campbell. There was no distribution. I was trying to impress the point on him.
I'm sorry. I thought that the other side said, yeah, there wasn't any distribution, but there should have been. And,
well, and
this
and
was rigged by his brother or whoever it was who...
My colleague may have an answer. I'm sure he will have an answer when it's his turn this morning. It's necessary for the court to hear evidence as to why there was no distribution, because there had been distributions in previous years, and this was a different. 2012 was a different year. When the agreement was written, oddly enough, was in 2013, but there were so many issues being resolved on that day when that property settlement agreement was negotiated that this particular issue of the John Hancock Fund was a small point at that time and didn't get a lot of attention in the negotiation between counsel and the parties. So essentially, what we're asking the court to do is just to send it back to the circuit court so that we can set it for an hour at that point be heard on it. There is one other point that I do need to make, and that is, and I've discussed this with Mr. Clements, that there is a misstatement on page 7 of the appellee's brief where the writer said the court chose the sum of $12,000. I'm sorry, I'm on page 7 in the second paragraph. The court chose the sum of $12,000 based on evidence that in 2010 and 2011 the appellant had received that amount. There is no evidence to that fact. In fact, that fact is a mistake.
Sir, where are you reading from again?
I'm sorry, Judge. It's the appellee's brief,
right.
Page 7, second paragraph.
The start, the language was clear?
Yes, sir. And second and third sentence. The writer goes on to say that as to that sole finding, which is a finding of fact, I take issue with that because Judge Campbell made no findings of fact. So I'm sure it was an accident, but that those are misstatements of fact, and I would like to reserve the rest of my time. Unless there are questions, I'm sorry.
Let me ask you this. When Judge Campbell said near the end of that August 8th hearing, I believe it was, that either he or Judge Rockwell would follow up with a written order, did Mr. Menninger have a duty to object and state that he wanted an evidentiary hearing at that point?
Judge, we would have made that objection had we drafted an order. This was also unusual because Judge Campbell drafted his own order. And in these days of instant communication, in fact, where the rules of court require us to put our fax number and our email on the documents we file, the Circuit Court of Chesterfield County put a 48-cent stamp on the order and mailed it to us. So it was a week after he entered it before we even knew. We didn't have a chance to object. I made the suggestion to him, and I felt since I did not know Judge Campbell, I was trying to be as succinct and polite as I could be. I didn't want to say something over and over again.
You did say early in the hearing that you needed an evidentiary hearing of longer than 30 minutes.
Yes, sir. That's in the appendix, page 31, at line 18.
You essentially argued that was enough in this situation.
Well, I was trying to politely make the suggestion that we wanted to come back on that, but I'll be candid with you that there was one other hot issue and involved the sale of a piece of real estate that we both counsel really wanted the judge to decide that because we and our clients couldn't come to agreement on that. So we wanted a ruling on that issue, and I guess I thought it was obvious that the court had not heard enough evidence to make a correct ruling on the one we're dealing with now.
Any further questions for Mr. Gatherer?
Thank you,
sir. You, the remainder of your time, you have for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Clements, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is David Clements. I represent Janet Menninger in this.
Mr. Clements, can I start off with what was the evidentiary basis for Judge Campbell's ruling?
Judge, I think, and I'll concede the fact that there was a misstatement there. It was based upon, that was clearly brought out in the record by extensive proffers, I think, by both counsel in this case, that the parties had a history. In fact, if you go specifically to...
Well, let's go back to my question.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
What was the evidentiary basis for the judge's ruling? What evidence did he rely on?
I think he relied upon I'd asked the court to take judicial notice of the final decree, the property settlement agreement, so those were properly admitted into evidence.
Well, there was a dispute, was there not, as what distribution meant under the property settlement agreement, was there not?
Well, Judge, I think the language in the property settlement agreement is one of those things he relied on in making that determination. Counsel did argue, and again, this is proffered argument, which I agree to, which I think is part of what the judge used to make that determination.
Well, what else could he have used? There's no evidence taken in this case.
I respectfully disagree because it's proffered evidence, which is acceptable evidence in a matter as long as the parties agree. You don't necessarily have to
call. Well, you proffered at one time that the reason why distribution wasn't made was because Mr. Gadberry's client, whoever handled the John Hancock, had that was your proffer.
I proffered that his brother was managing that
account. Well, and so you think that Judge Campbell said, oh, well, I accept your proffer and I reject Mr. Canterbury's? Is that what the judge did?
No, I'm not saying that. I think both parties, he heard the issue, and then the proffer of the testimony is basically he didn't fund. We accepted the proffer that no
what
distribution.
What testimony are you talking
the proffer
about?
Testimony by counsel.
Okay.
I'll concede there was no live testimony from any witnesses.
Well, I gather you can see no evidence was taken on this hearing other than proffers of counsel.
The only evidence, Judge, would be the where I moved in the documents I think were necessary.
Other than the documentary evidence.
That's correct.
No evidence was taken other than the proffer of counsel.
I think that's a fair statement, yes, sir.
And the proffers of counsel were in dispute, were they not?
I don't see that we're really in a factual dispute in this case. In regards to this specific issue.
You're saying
issue,
there's no dispute in this case with respect to this issue? Are you seriously saying that?
I am, Judge, because it's our position, like the court was asking earlier, is that was
if there's
there
no
a
dispute, why aren't we
no
here?
Distribution? Well,
if there's no dispute on this issue, why are we here?
There's factual disputes because he has a theory of law that says that's why I think we're here. Not necessarily a factual dispute, but a theory of law that differs.
Virginia Constitution says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, and property without due process of law. Due process of law. You think due process of law includes the right to call witnesses?
Yes, sir. But I think in this case, counsel conceded that fact when the judge specifically taking you to the last page.
So it's your position that counsel that Mr. Canterbury have conceded the right to put on evidence?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Can you please point me to where in the appendix there was any sort of agreement, formal or otherwise, that the evidence in this case would simply be done by way of proffer?
Judge, specifically,
I'm looking, and I just can't find the word proffer anywhere in this transcript.
Well,
I see repeated references to opening statements, but nothing to proffer.
Right, and that's the way we proceeded, Judge. I don't think I ever used that term technically to proffer, but I put forth my client's position, which I argue then the court accepted as a proffer. There was no objection to us proceeding this way by counsel. And then in the end, the court said, well, we'll go with that. I will talk with Judge Rockwell between the two of us. We'll get an order out. Either of you can agree or challenge it. All right. With the question, both counsel and I agreed. Thank you, Your Honor. So it was an agreement that the facts were already in. And that one of his positions is, if the judge needs more time, then set it down for an hour. If you think you need more time, you can set it down for an hour. But he doesn't come out and say, Judge, I object. We actually have to have evidence you're hearing. We need to call witnesses. That goes back to me why I think he's procedurally barred here, is there's no clear objection on the record here under 5A18.
What was the proffer with respect to the amount of the distribution? The
specific language, if I may, going to my argument.
How did Judge Campbell come up with $12,000?
Because the agreement of the parties, specifically in the property settlement agreement, said a distribution in the amount of $6,000, $12,000 shall be divided among the parties.
Okay, that's what it said. But how did he determine, well, the distribution was $12,000?
I think he determined that from the proffers of counsel, for both counsel that went in, as well as the history of the parties, and then the language that specifically
says
in the history.
Tell me in the record.
Yes, Judge.
Where you said the distribution was $12,000, $12,000.
I never said that in the record, Judge. I'm not going to try to mislead the court. And I apologize. There was a misstatement in my brief, and I could see that when counsel pointed that
well,
out.
How did Judge Campbell come up with $12,000?
I think, again, by the proffers of counsel in this case, that in this case we proffered as the history of the parties that they received a distribution, and in this case.
Thank you.
And the judge, in addition to saying that there might be an order that comes out, it also said that he wanted to discuss it with Judge Rockwell and that Judge Rockwell might want to take the case back.
That's
Is
correct.
That correct?
That's correct.
So at that point in time, you don't know whether you're going to get an order or you're going to get word from Judge Rockwell that he wants to take the case back.
That's correct. So I assume the judge, by providing the order, had the evidence he thought necessary to make the proper ruling.
So what was there to object to at the time of the hearing when you've got kind of an either-or situation as to what may happen with this?
Well, this is where I think counsel needs to clearly judge before the court needs. I think we need to have it. We would object to proceeding by way of an order because the court is indicating to counsel at the very end, I will come back with an order. And in that case, even when he gets an order, I think counsel could still file a written objection on the record as to why at that point. He chooses not to. He files a motion to rehear outlining what, and again, providing more facts that were not in there. and then arguing that it should be set down for a hearing again, which is also dismissed. Because again, I don't think under 5A18 that he properly preserved his objections to the court's ruling or the procedure.
Let me ask you on that, because the circuit court seemed to be aware of the arguments that was made in the motion to reconsider the August 14th order. And the circuit court actually then ruled upon that and denied that motion to reconsider in the August 29th order.
Correct.
So if the purpose of 5A18 is make sure the court's aware, why wasn't that purpose accomplished here?
Well, it's not accomplished for two reasons. Number one, as you know, the case law also talks, is not only is it to bring the court's attention, let the court the opportunity maybe to fix whatever the issue is, but it also gives opposing counsel to write at this point to come in to maybe offer a cure way as well to try to fix the situation. And this is done, again, he could have filed his objection to the court's rulings. He could have, line by line, there was no evidence. He could have done that, and then would be properly before the court. But with all due respect, I don't think he did it properly with the motion to reconsider. It's technically possible. I understand in the case law even says that. But I don't think in this case did he purposely delineate the errors as we bring in forth to the court of appeals today.
Let me ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel, Mr. Gadbury, at the beginning of his argument. Elaborate further on what you have so far, if you can, on the $12,000 and where the trial judge gets that, and if any distribution actually occurred at all of any amount.
Counsel, I took his proffer testimony at the hearing as there was no distribution at all. He also put forth his client's doing quite well financially. We put in the fact that I proffered that his brother was overseeing this account. And that he also puts forth that because they were paying spousal support at the time, that they did not fund in the 401k as much. So all of that testimony was, with respect to the judge, was out there by way of proffer. And the judge had all that rule. So he had not only the intent of the parties, which I think is about as clearly as outlined, even though it was not, because there was a little bit of area as to what it would be.
So Judge Campbell, he ruled on the credibility of your proffer as compared to the credibility of this gentleman's proffer. Is that what happened?
No, sir. Obviously, I think.
But how did he resolve the conflict?
I think he resolved the conflict, understanding the proffer is that no distribution was paid out, the fact that the parties agreed that a distribution would take place.
So they said if a distribution took place. That's what the agreement said.
If I may, let me jump to that. I don't want to mislead the court, but I thought I had a different wording.
Well, in any event, my question, how did the judge resolve these conflicts in evidence? Proffered evidence.
Proffered evidence, the property settlement agreement, the final decree, basically the intent of the parties as to what it would, that the parties intended to divide a distribution from that account. Counsel then comes in at the show cause hearing and say, well, it's really not, even though they agreed to the language in the property settlement agreement, now it's a misnomer. Now it's actually a refund of a top-heavy 401k. So they came in with a different explanation, even though the parties agreed at the time. So whether it was a late-day afternoon discussion, which conceded it was still discussed and everybody agreed to the language put in. And then no distribution takes place. And counsel's now even saying, wait a minute, that had actually taken place beforehand. So then it's countless. So if I understand his argument is, the meeting, the hearing takes place, the property settlement agreement is entered in 2013, the distribution should have already taken place. His client, at this point, basically acknowledges that he did not know the amount, but an amount between that amount would take place. And then,
following up on Judge Haley and Judge Beal's line of questioning, where is the evidence, proffered or otherwise, for the trial judge to reach a conclusion that it's a $12,000 distribution as opposed to a $6,000 distribution?
I wish I could provide a better answer to Your Honor, and I'm not trying to be flippant with you, but I've tried to argue that same point. I think it is based upon, again, the intent of the parties, the proffered testimony that we had in this case, that no distribution took place. It should have taken place, and he made, based upon the evidence that he heard that day, he made a finding that it should have been a $12,000 in split.
Should have been or was?
There was none. We've conceded, counsel.
Well, that's, yeah. So you concede
We can see that no distribution took place.
No distribution
I trust was counsel's
ever,
representation that,
no,
that never
no
took place.
No distribution was ever made.
So it's our position, though, again, because of the fact that his brother was managing the account, which I believe was accepted, and the fact that he chose not to fund that account, those are all in the party's intent. The judge then rendered based upon that information and that the evidence,
right.
The proper evidence. So again, it's our arguments first. Procedurally, I'm going to try to jump back to my brief here briefly. Procedurally, I think he's barred. I view it as three different violations here. Partially the property settlement agreement that was severely redacted in this, even though it was clearly lined out on his, in Rule 5A.20 talks about the appendix as well as the designation of the record. He clearly talks about using the property settlement agreement to file a decree as well as the trial transcripts. He doesn't say these specific pages. The appendix then gets printed, and then at that point I can see that they're severely redacted. 5A.18, again, it's my position that he never clearly, properly preserved an appeal, so I think this appeal should be dismissed. And
the entire property settlement agreement, although not in the appendix, it's in the record, though, right?
Yes. I believe so, but I think if it's properly for the appendix, at least my understanding, I'm not going to then tell you I'm an appellate expert, is that it should be in the appendix for the court to
review. Prefer it that way. That's good.
I'll try to keep everybody happy when I can. Going into his argument specifically then, real quick, it's our position, obviously, the court did not err. The judgment is presumed correct. Glenn, pointing to the specific language I have on my page 6 of my brief, specifically outlines the language in the property settlement agreement. So my position that obviously the judge relied on the final decree, the property settlement agreement specifically, extensive proffers and testimony, both by counsel in this case, to make that proper decision. We're asking, number two, is our opinion is plain language controls. The court can read the intent of the parties. This is a contract case. It's the intent of the parties. You read it on the four corners of the document. Counsel even conceded that in the transcripts. It should be on the four corners of the document. That's why I say the court can hopefully review even the full property settlement agreement. And then lastly here, again, when we get down to it, I think the judge clearly pointed out that he's going to make a determination based upon it, and they will be getting out an order, and that he could have then at that point object.
Can I ask you one quick question?
Sure.
I'm sorry, what was the name of the prior judge in this case?
Rockwell was the sitting judge. Judge Campbell was the...
Judge Rockwell?
Judge Rockwell.
Did Judge Rockwell ever hear any evidence concerning the issues, those matters which were at issue in the hearing that Judge Campbell...
He heard part of the case. Obviously, we argued.
So I meant on these issues.
Not on these specific issues of show cause. No, Judge.
And so, to the extent that Judge Campbell was going to talk to Judge Rockwell, which y'all agreed to, Judge Rockwell will have no knowledge whatsoever of any evidence involving these issues.
Agreed.
Okay.
And counsel agreed that that was appropriate, that it would be okay to go discuss that with Judge Rockwell to see if he wanted to set down for a hearing or did they have enough evidence. It's my position, the counsel then conceded the fact that they basically, by proffers to counsel, that both of our sides were presented. It's my position that this appeal should be dismissed or affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clements. Mr. Gadbury, you have your remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Couple of points that I would like to respond to. Obviously, there is a factual dispute in this case, excuse me, as to whether there was a distribution. The fact of whether there was a distribution is very important because of the language, the language from the property settlement agreement that says that the distribution shall be divided equally. It does not say the husband shall pay the wife half of his distribution. It says the distribution shall be divided equally. If the facts bear out that the distribution was $1, he owes her 50 cents. And that's what we're trying to get to with having a hearing in this matter to establish the facts. The other thing that's going to be borne out, and I mentioned it parenthetically in my argument, is the fact that the previous paragraph in the property settlement agreement says, by the way, here are all the investments in 401ks that this couple has over a 30-year marriage, and they're going to be divided equally. and there was a quadro, and over $300,000 was divided equally at that point. One of the things that would come out in a hearing on this is the fact that this lady has already gotten her half. She got half of all the quadro, of all the, 401ks and IRAs after the final decree was entered. There's nothing more. There wasn't anything to divide in 2013. There's not anything to divide now because the parties have already gotten their halves. And that's one of the facts that would be established if the court were to hear all of the facts to know all there is to know and make a correct decision. I'm concerned about the word proffer, and I agree with the court saying that the word proffer really doesn't appear in the transcript anywhere. It was not my intention to proffer anything. My understanding of a proffer is when my evidence has been restricted, and I've tried to offer something and my opponent objects and the court sustains the objection, but I still want to get that something in the record about this, that's when I make a proffer and say, well, Judge, if this witness did testify, here's what he or she would have said. That's my understanding of a proffer. I was not trying to do that, and I think the transcript bears that out. We were making opening statements on that day, and there was so much to be said that we
there's certainly no language whatsoever that can be construed as a stipulation of facts in the exchange between counsel.
Yes, sir.
No language whatsoever that you could say, oh, we're stipulating these facts.
Yes, sir. I agree. I did not make an objection in the record because I thought the motion for reconsideration said it all. There is a case, the Weedman case, Weedman versus Babcock at 241 Virginia, where there was a motion for reconsideration, and the court in that case said that it did satisfy the necessity of raising an objection.
What's the name of that case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Weedman is Weidman versus Babcock, Babcock.
241 Virginia.
241 Virginia 40.
Okay, thank you.
Essentially, I thank you. I've talked longer than I wanted to talk, but I thank you for the opportunity, and I hope that we'll just simply send this back to the circuit court and let the judge decide it there.
Any further questions for Mr. Gadbury?
No, sir.
I have not. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gadbury. We will re-counsel. Before we do, counsel in the